The atomic bombs that ended World War II killed over 100, perhaps over 200,000 people. Over the past generation, there's been a revisionist debate. Did the United States drop 2 atomic bombs to avoid a land invasion that might have killed 1 million Americans and millions of Japanese? Or did they drop the bomb to avoid the Soviet army coming in and sharing the spoils of conquering Japan or for some other geopolitical goal? Were the prospects of a land invasion even more destructive than the opening of the nuclear age? D.M. Jean Greco, who was an editor for Military Review, has written a new book that takes advantage of declassified materials in both the United States and Japan to try to answer those questions. It's published by the Naval Institute Press and called Hell to Pay, Operation Downfall and the Invasion of Japan, 1945-1947. Mr. Jean Greco joins us from member station KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, glad to be here.
Help us understand what U.S. military planners had to look at as they contemplated a land invasion of Japan in 1943. Because as you suggest in this book, there were even some military units that were U.S. units that were held back from possible action in Berlin because it was understood they'd have to be sent to the Pacific.
Right. There was a very, very tight timetable. And everything had to work in terms of shipping, you know, the movement of troops, because there was clearly not enough forces in the Pacific to be able to carry this off.
Mm-hmm. And maybe we should explain, at least at that point in their planning, the participation of other Allied forces would have been limited, including Great Britain, France, Canada. For that matter, the Soviet Union, because they had been fighting the war longer than the United States, and they had just won and had to get back to life.
Well, yes, that's exactly right. What they were essentially looking at for the invasion of Japan was what would functionally be a duplication of the casualty surge in Europe that was principally driven by combat in Europe, that would be repeated in the Pacific. And that was not a pleasant prospect.
Let me get to another aspect, if I could. In history, it is often said that war planners had projected that a land invasion of Japan would have cost the lives of 1 million U.S. soldiers and many more Japanese. Where does that figure come from, and does it seem right to you?
Well, you have to remember that these figures are basically put together by planning staff's best guess from, you know, say the terrain, the number of units that are going to be fielded, the number of enemy units that they're going to have to fight. And as early as middle part of 1944, when we started getting a pretty firm grasp of just how casualties were playing out, and they ultimately came to the conclusion that the casualties on the low end would be somewhere in the neighborhood perhaps of, say, about 250,000, and on the upper end in through the million range.
Mm-hmm. Someone who reads your book has struck time and time again how the Americans and the Japanese looked at the same experience and derive totally different conclusions. The invasion and battles of Okinawa and Iwo Jima were ruinous in terms of casualties, for the Japanese even more than the Americans. The Americans extrapolated from that information, well, the battles were bloody and costly, but in the end it was worth it because the Japanese now understand that we are going to prevail. The Japanese looked at those same numbers and said, well, the battles were bloody and costly, but they were worth it because it gave us more time to prepare for the defense of our homeland, and the Americans must know we are prepared to suffer casualties at a rate they are not.
Yes, these are the same people who, after 2 atomic bombs and the Russian entry into the war, were still saying, no, we can do this because we're still going to be able to, like, force them to invade because they surely can't have more atomic bombs.
What about the argument, Mr. Jean Greco, that in 1945 Japan was essentially defeated, even if they didn't know it?
Well, certainly there's a lot to that argument, but defeat and surrender are two very different things. Like, if
the,
you
the,
use
the
that
point of that being a nation might be defeated, but until they surrender, that perception is kind of useless.
Well, yes. I think that it is quite reasonable to argue that they would have been even harder to convince than the Germans. The Germans at least surrendered in fairly large numbers when they saw a hopeless situation. But the only time you ended up getting large numbers of Japanese to surrender was basically in Manchuria when the emperor said, "Surrender now." And for the first time in the war, you actually started getting, you know, large numbers of Japanese laying down their arms.
In your appendix, toward the end of the book, you have a very moving letter written by James Michener.
Oh, yes.
The novelist, who we sometimes forget, began his writing career, Tales of the South Pacific, which was made, of course, into a famous musical, ultimately. James Michener was from a Quaker background. He was a man of peace. And he wrote a letter, October 20 of 1995, essentially saying there was no alternative to the end of World War II the way the U.S. ended it. But he didn't let that letter be released until after his death, did he?
Well, no. It much to the frustration of a couple friends of his, but for his own personal reasons, he really did not feel that he could let his views be public.
He says in this letter, "I know if I went public with my views, I would be condemned and ridiculed." But recollecting his time in the South Pacific, he said, "I stood there on the lip of the pulsating volcano, and I know that I was terrified at what might happen and damned relieved when the invasion became unnecessary. I accept the military estimates that at least 1 million lives were saved, and mine could have been one of them."
Yep, there's a lot of Americans and Japanese who are alive today because we did not have to go in. It's astounding. While we were looking at some of our own casualty estimates, the Japanese military was doing much the same thing. And the figure of 20 million appears again and again.
20 million again, Japanese who would have been killed.
Yes. Well, in some references, it is to Japanese killed. In others, it is to casualties.
Yeah.
But yes, it was the number is horrific. But the casualness with which it was used and that they felt it was worth it. It's just stunning to me when you go through some of this material.
Mr. Gingreco, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
D.M. Gingreco, the author of Hell to Pay, Operation Downfall and the Invasion of Japan, 1945-1947, joined us from member station KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri.
The new book, Game Change, has gotten a lot of media attention for revelations about the 2008 presidential campaign. The book forced Senator Harry Reid to apologize for remarks about President Obama's race, and it served up detailed accounts of John Edwards' self-absorption and Sarah Palin's ignorance of foreign affairs. But as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, the book also forces readers to decide just how much they trust the journalists who wrote it.
Game Change is so juicy, I could hardly put it down. And yet, when I flipped to the part that cited the sources, I found, hold on a sec here. Oh, that's right. I found no named sources, no footnotes, no nothing in the entire book.
From the very outset, we wanted to try to write a book that was narrative-driven, that was character-driven, in the omniscient voice, and to write it in the way that we've done it, in a novelistic way.
Longtime political journalist John Heilemann is one of the authors of Game Change, along with Mark Halperin of Time magazine. The two men wrote that they conducted interviews with 200 people. All were done on deep background, which they say meant they could use anything they were told, but that no sources would be identified in any way. Heilemann says that promise ensured candor.
It was the decision we made at the beginning, and we're perfectly comfortable with it and happy with it. And it's worked out, we think it worked out very well in terms of serving the public interest and getting us what we wanted to get, which was an unvarnished look at the high human drama of this campaign.
The book is said to be flying off the shelves, but there is that lingering question asked recently on Talk of the Nation by the caller Polly from Wilmington, North Carolina.
You know, I saw you on TV describing a really personal moment where Elizabeth Edwards had a meltdown, and I just thought, exactly where were your sources for that?
The authors say they're honor-bound not to say, so Polly and the rest of us can't verify how true it is. Melinda Henneberger is a former reporter for The New York Times and Newsweek, who is now editor of PoliticsDaily.com. The website gave the book plenty of copy.
You know, we had been saying that this is this genre done for, especially after all the Obama campaign books. Can there be any sugar left in the gum? Is there anything that hasn't been rehashed to death? And as it turns out, there was plenty.
But she says she has qualms about the lack of explicit sourcing in the book.
Because these are two journalists with a reputation for accuracy and fairness, and they are, we're really being asked to trust on faith that everything in it is completely accurate without the kind of sourcing that you would have for a news story.
The authors say they're following a strong nonfiction tradition. Co-author Mark Halperin.
We didn't invent this notion of the balance between full openness and getting information. And I think if you look at why some people are attracted to the book, it's because of the quality of the material.
But plenty of journalists manage to get good information about sensitive topics and yet still provide readers insight about their sources. The author Jane Mayer had hundreds of footnotes in her book, The Dark Side, about torture during the George W. Bush years. The Towson University scholar Martha Joint Kumar actually revealed in an academic journal the scramble by White House officials to thwart a feared terrorist plot against President Obama's inauguration. How did she get her scoop? From interviews with former President Bush's chief of staff and national security advisor.
When I do interviews, I do them on the record. I have a tape recorder. I put it down, turn it on, and say what the ground rules are.
When sources are named, Kumar says,
you probably wouldn't get the same kind of quotes, the very juicy quotes, but is that what a book is about?
She says too often anonymous sources settle scores rather than serve history. Heilemann and Halperin say they led them to material you haven't read anywhere else. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
A year ago this week, when Barack Obama stood on the steps of the U.S. Capitol to take the presidential oath of office, it was often described as the climax of a journey that began 46 years earlier at the other end of the National Mall on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed.
That's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, in his famous address at the 1963 March on Washington. And this weekend, we honor Dr. King's legacy with a national holiday. But according to historian Peniel Joseph, there's another line of succession in African-American leadership, one that reaches from President Obama back to this man.
You got a right to protect yourself by any means necessary.
By any means necessary, the words of Malcolm X. Peniel Joseph's new book is called Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. And Peniel Joseph joins me from our New York Bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You argue that this connection between Barack Obama and the Black Power movement has largely been ignored by historians, by the media, by pundits. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that the connection between Black Power and Barack Obama doesn't fit a neat and simplistic national narrative about the success and evolution of the civil rights struggle. And it's really a narrative that Obama himself contributed to when he invoked Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr. When we think about the Black Power movement, Black Power is usually characterized as a movement of gun-toting militants who practice politics without portfolio and drag down a more promising movement for social justice, in this case, the civil rights movement. And one of the things that I argue in this book is that when we think about Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael, at the heart, at the root, these were two organizers who tried to organize at the local and then national level to try to transform American democratic institutions.
But there was a violent aspect to it as well. I mean, Stokely Carmichael was obviously involved with founding the Black Panther movement. I mean, there was definitely a kind of a hard edge to some of what he was saying.
Absolutely. When we think about violence and the rhetoric of Black Power, violence does play a role in the iconography of this movement. But one of the things I argue empirically when we look at the history of the movement, most Black Power activists were not violent. Most did not use violence in their rhetoric. So when we think about violence, violence is definitely an important part of this story, but I also think it's one whose legacy in terms of the movement has been overstated.
I want to hear a clip of what President Obama wrote in his memoir, Dreams for My Father, about what set Malcolm X apart from other black leaders of the era.
Only Malcolm X's autobiography seemed to offer something different. His repeated acts of self-creation spoke to me.
Peniel Joseph, how important was Malcolm X as an influence, do you think, to Barack Obama?
Well, I think Malcolm is really important in the sense that Malcolm is the quintessential self-made African-American political activist and political icon and leader of the post-war period. So Malcolm is really coming from a really humble background. He grows up in Roxbury, Detroit, and Harlem. He becomes a thief, a burglar, a pimp, a dope peddler, and is imprisoned by the time he's 21 in 1946. And it's really in prison that he becomes a new, different type of person. So when we think about Malcolm X, Malcolm X is a great example of a self-made man. And Barack Obama admires self-made men in American history.
Peniel Joseph, you point to Malcolm X's early years as an activist when he was a community organizer. Is that, in your view, the kind of primary link between President Obama and people like Malcolm X and others you describe, like Stokely Carmichael?
Absolutely. I think at their core, they are community organizers. Malcolm organized in the streets of Harlem in the 1950s, but also in places like Philadelphia and Detroit. Then Stokely Carmichael is a quintessential civil rights organizer turned black power militant in the 1960s.
Stokely Carmichael coined the term black power, and I want to play a bit of a speech he gave around that time in the year 1966.
Now, we are engaged in a psychological struggle in this country, and that is whether or not black people will have the right to use the words they want to use without white people giving their sanction to it. And that we maintain, whether they like it or not, we're going to use the word black power and let them address themselves to that.
Peniel Joseph, you acknowledge in the book that this kind of tone is very different, of course, from the message that President Obama delivered as a candidate and delivers as president. Yet you argue that people like Stokely Carmichael helped pave the way for the future president.
Well, when we think about the black power movement, people like Carmichael actually transform our understanding and definition of black identity. They also transform the sphere of politics. So before the black power movement, there's no Congressional Black Caucus. There isn't a generation of black mayors and black politicians. It's black power militants who really precipitate the utilization of racial solidarity to bring black elected officials prominence.
In your view, which legacy is more responsible for the ascendancy of President Obama, the legacy of Malcolm X or the legacy of Dr. King?
Well, I would answer that by saying, really, I do believe it's both equally. I think Dr. King and his vision of a transcendent, multiracial, multicultural democracy is pivotal in shaping both Obama, but also shaping race relations and opportunities that allowed Obama to go to Harvard, that allowed Obama to go to Columbia and to become president of the United States. But I also believe that Malcolm X and his envelope-pushing critique of American democracy gave people like King room to operate and maneuver, and also helped mobilize political protest that actually transformed political and educational and social institutions on the ground in ways that played a particularly important role in getting Obama elected as well.
Peniel Joseph teaches history at Tufts University. His new book is called Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Peniel Joseph, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Best-selling authors died in the past several days, and both of them are associated with one particular city, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Eric Segal was an accomplished classic scholar, but he's best known for the tearjerker Love Story. And mystery writer Robert Parker was the man behind the Spencer series. Commentator Mo Lottman reflects on their legacies and the city that inspired their most popular works.
If you live in or around Cambridge, Massachusetts, the news this week has marked the end of an era. And no, I'm not talking about the Scott Brown Senate victory. two famous writers with local connections have passed away. One penned the novel and screenplay Love Story, perhaps the most famous movie ever set here. The other lived in Harvard Square and put his most celebrated character in the alleys and bars of the neighborhood. On the surface, it would seem the two men have little in common. Okay, maybe it's not just on the surface. Eric Segal was a rabbi's son from Brooklyn who eventually moved to England. Robert Parker was born and bred in Massachusetts, served in Korea, and lived on Ash Street in Cambridge until his death. Segal wrote one enormously successful work and then largely faded from the spotlight. Parker churned out bestseller after bestseller, some of which were turned into television shows and films. Parker was a gruff but unpretentious family man who named a succession of dogs Pearl and hated academics. Segal was fluent in several languages and a professor at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Oxford. To get an idea for the difference, just look at who played the leading men in the screen adaptations of their work. With Parker, it's Robert Urich, Tom Selleck, and Ed Harris. With Segal, it's Ryan O'Neill. But Cambridge is a funny place. Like Love Story's Oliver Barrett IV and Jenny Cavallari, it's a marriage between Brahmin and working class, a mix that, like Jenny's owl glasses, shouldn't work, but does. Harvard has turned out presidents, princes, senators, and Supreme Court justices, but it also hired Timothy Leary. A whole generation of psychedelic wanderers have hung out in Harvard Square, as did the founders of Microsoft. The Boston Bruins drank at the Oxford Grill, where bar brawls would spill out into the street every weekend. But 50 feet away, earnest guitarists sang to hushed audiences in the liquor-free folk club Passim. Jugglers hammed it up for summer strollers, while punks in studded collars lit up doobies on the subway plaza. Even Parker Spencer knew that brawn and street smarts was better leavened with a little sophistication. Sure, he was a tough detective and an ex-boxer, but he was also a gourmet who dated a psychologist. Before he was famous, Robert Parker wrote manuals for Raytheon. A snippet of technical writing for a missile begins, "To start, push to start button." Before he was famous, Segal wrote a 300-page essay on the comedy of Roman playwright Plautus. Somehow, both of these gentlemen represent Cambridge, Massachusetts, in all its contradictory glory. Here's hoping they're sharing a whiskey or a lemon spritzer in the great Harvard Square in the sky.
Commentator Mo Lottman remembering the late writers Eric Segal and Robert Parker. Lottman is author of Harvard Square, an Illustrated History since 1950. ¶¶